Welcome to the South Fellowship Church podcast. Here at South Fellowship, we exist to help people live in the way of Jesus with the heart of Jesus. Wherever you're listening from today, we hope you're encouraged by this week's message.
Middle school is leaving, so if you're part of the middle school group, traditional ovation for them. If you're visiting, welcome. My name is Alex. I'm one of the pastors here. It's great to have you here. I'd like to begin this morning by addressing the elephant in the room. Not the small children's bike on stage. Not that elephant. I'd like to start by addressing this elephant. I know. Just give me it. Come on. It's fine. It's the kids I feel sorry for, not you guys. Now, hopefully, like, the goal around here is that everything happens for a reason. That doesn't always happen, but that's the goal, right? That there's a purpose behind it. And so I know that it must feel unfeeling that on daylight savings day, when you lost an hour of sleep and you had to dash here to church, you got here and the donuts that are there are gone. They're gone for a reason. Don't you think it's interesting that there's certain things in life that we get used to, that when they're gone, we actually suddenly realize, oh, wow, that has become a thing. Perhaps you found that on Sunday morning, because of your expectations, you walk through the door and saliva begins to develop in your mouth. It's like, oh yeah, I'm ready. Perhaps it happens as you pull into the parking lot. Perhaps it happens on Broadway or as you leave your house, but you know you're gonna get your sugar rush. And even better, it's going to be free. It's going to be just handed to you, and you're going to be ready for it. There is a way that our body gets used to certain things. It becomes a thing that we depend on. This isn't just exclusively true of donuts. This is true of so many different things. I remember some time ago that I had a personal trainer, and he reminded me that your body gets used to certain training habits. He said to me, listen, when you lift weights in a particular way, your body then gets used to that. It knows what to expect, so it prepares itself. I reminded him that the fact that I was even here in the first place was a pretty big deal, but he wanted me to get better at what I did. One of the other elements that we might see this is when I show you a picture of this lemon with a knife beginning to cut through it, and you might start to feel that sense of your mouth preparing yourself for the taste of a lemon, that sharpness. If you've never tried a lemon, then you wouldn't understand. There's been two ideas around the body in philosophy and in theology. One of the ideas is this: the body is evil. The body is bad. So actually, just do whatever you want with your body. It can't harm you. There's this spirit part to you that is different, that is separate. So do what you want with your body, but don't do what you want with your spirit. Be careful, nurture your spirit. Does that sound like a philosophy you've heard kind of in the modern culture? But that's where we're at, right? We have this world now that says it doesn't matter what you do. Like, there's this spiritual side to you. Deeply inside, you're a spiritual person. Fascinatingly, Christianity has never said that. The way of Jesus has always said your body is valuable and deeply attached to who you are. When we talk about body versus spirit, Christianity has said, actually, no, body, spirit, it's all one. But the body is kind of at times out of whack. It needs to be controlled. Today, we're going to push into the conversation around fasting. So if you have this moment where you say, I really wasn't going to come this morning, and I kind of regret being here now, then I understand. It's like the most uncomfortable of spiritual disciplines. Who wants to go without donuts on a Sunday morning? And yet fasting has been part of this Christian tradition for years. Richard Foster says this: in many ways, the stomach is like a spoiled child, and a spoiled child does not need indulgence, but needs discipline. So sometimes when you speak on a subject, you're invited to speak into your strengths. Sometimes you get to speak into your weaknesses. And I'll own this. I've been through years of fasting regularly and then stopped, and I have never felt good at it. I've always felt like, I just don't enjoy this at all. Other people I know do it regularly and say they absolutely love it as a discipline. But out of all the disciplines, other than perhaps the discipline of silence and solitude, I would say this. Fasting is the most transformative discipline that I have come across. So if you're someone who says, I deeply like to grow in the way of Jesus, I'd like to become more aware of him in this world, then I highly recommend that you tune in. This spiritual discipline of fasting is part of a triad that includes the two that we've kind of covered. We've talked about giving, and we've talked about prayer. They're both important for a reason, and almost every monotheistic faith takes these three spiritual disciplines and says, keep doing these things. So giving, it seems, opposes our desire to value ourselves more than others. When you have something that's valuable to you, you let it go, and that means something. You might say prayer opposes our desire to be in control. What did we say all the way through this section we just covered on the Lord's Prayer? This is a prayer of surrender. The heartbeat says, I'm not in control. God is in control. And so we have been intentionally through this season praying as a community. A little nudge reminder, we're in the middle of this cycle, 24/7 prayer. Hopefully you've got some practice by now. Because as we move to this time of Holy Week, where we celebrate Jesus' death and his resurrection, we want to fill that calendar. So if you've done it already, if you tried jumping in on this, go back to 24/7 prayer, find a slot to sign up. We just want to cover this whole church and community in prayer during this season. We have giving, we have prayer, and then we have the third one, which is fasting. This is a triad, and Jesus does this beautiful kind of thing here. He kind of approaches it this way. Each of the triad comes with a how not to, followed by a how to. Don't give like this, give like this. Don't pray like this, pray like this. Don't fast like this, as we'll see, fast like this. He takes something that's old, and he says, we're going to do that in a new Jesus-like way, so jump on to that. But when you kind of capture hold of some of those, don't do it like this, do it like this, there's just a chance that you might say, I feel kind of guilty at times. How many of you have tried praying in a group of people out loud and not spent most of your time focusing on what other people might think about what you're saying? If that's been a struggle for you, you can just throw up your hand and say, that's been a hard thing. The moment that I'm praying in a group, there's this part of me that wants to know what people think, that wants to say the right words. When I give something, I kind of have this sense that I feel like somebody should know that I did it at times. And when I'm doing something hard, like fasting, there's something in me that wants to share that with people. I think there's a chance that read in the wrong way, Jesus, don't do it like this, do it like this statements, they actually can cause a chunk of guilt. So I want to free you from that today. Because I don't think Jesus' goal is feel guilty because you're doing it wrong. I actually think across these whole three disciplines, it's this invitation to do it in a different way. This ties in beautifully with the last verse of Matthew chapter 5, the chapter we spent last year on before chapter 6. 5 comes before 6, in case you missed that. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. When we looked at this verse, actually the translation might be better read like this. Be mature, therefore, as your heavenly Father is mature. It's an invitation to grow up. And that's why it's really important that you understand the art of cycling. There is this idea to spiritual disciplines that they start off new. And then after a while, they become something else. After a while, they're no longer new. They become normal. And then they become natural. There's this beginning piece that starts right here on a bike like this that might end up riding around a velodrome in the Olympics. The moment of beginning to catch a ball with your parent may become a moment where you throw a ball in the major leagues. The starting point matters. It's not bad It's just the starting point. And so I wanted to show you the cutest little starting point I could find.
Okay. So, last time I have to go.
Okay.
I'm going to go two laps.
Okay.
There, back.
Okay. Okay. Watch your legs, people. Whoa. Yeah. Watch my two laps. Here I go. Look at me, everyone. I'm riding a bike. Woo. Oh, watch the handbags. Thank you. Coming around. Rod, watch out for your walking stick. Oh, whew. How's it going? Look at me coming in for the big landing. Woo! Look at me. I was riding a bike. Perhaps you can catch hold of the heartbeat of what Jesus might be saying here. There is a level of something new that naturally involves some observation. A child that rides a bike for the first time, gotta catch my breath, it's hard work, can very justly say something like, look at me, Dad, I'm riding a bike. That's a big deal. That's a step into a first something. But a 40-year-old man who rides the bike around an auditorium is just desperate for attention and needs some spiritual help. A kid that throws a baseball for the first time can be celebrated and wants people to see that he's learning to do something new. But if you go to a Rockies game and see one of the outfielders yelling, hey, look at me, I'm throwing a baseball, then something might be off and might explain the results last year. I don't know. Might be a thing. This is the heartbeat, I think, to what Jesus is saying. Grow into maturity. Learn to do this a different way. Learn that the motivation behind these spiritual disciplines is not what anybody thinks. It's this invitation to become more like your Father, this invitation to know what He wants and where He is asking you to grow. So keep that in mind as we move into Matthew chapter 6, verse 16. If you have a text in front of you, I'm going to read it, and then we'll kind of get into this. When you fast, as always, there's a do not first. Do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Jesus, as we get into this, would you make your way into our hearts? And would you take our dreams, our goals, our ambitions, and focus them on you? Would you take our need to impress people and recognize that actually what we need is you? Would you take all of the things that we think are important and necessary in life, and would you fill us with a deep spiritual hunger that leads us towards you? Because this is all about you. Amen. Do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Each one of these spiritual disciplines that we're learning about, the idea of giving, the idea of prayer, the idea of fasting, was an everyday activity for a Jewish person living in the first century. Giving alms was considered essential. If you didn't, then there was something wrong. The average Jewish person, the goal was to give 20% of your income to different things. Anything more was considered unacceptable, but 20% was the goal. Prayer was prayed every single day. The Shema would be prayed every morning by Jewish people in the first century. And fasting, too, would become a twice weekly activity. A good Orthodox Jewish person in the first century would fast every Tuesday and every Thursday. These are rhythms that were just normal, now natural to everyday life. But it seems that as some other spiritual disciplines had been done in a negative way, there were some people that had taken to doing fasting in a negative way. They would intentionally disfigure their faces. They would sometimes draw lines on their faces to look like they were overly tired, look like they hadn't gone without food for a long period of time, to give that impression to everyone, oh, there's something going on here. This person must be doing another fast, perhaps multiple days, perhaps a long period of time. This was the approach to fasting that Jesus is warning against. It seems like that something like fasting can be done for the wrong reasons and turned into a show. This is the illusionist David Blaine in 2003. He decided to do a 44-day fast in a box of glass walls. People got to watch as he slowly lost 25% of his body weight, as he gathered the attention of media from all over the world, as people stopped and stared. He did this twice, or something like it twice. He was received very well over here. For some reason, the British people were far less kind to him, and people would gather out and do barbecues, cooking burgers underneath his glass box just to taunt him and allow the smell to waft up. It didn't go down well for whatever reason. He took fasting and turned it into a spectacle. This is not the first time this has happened, it seems. It happened in the first century and happened in different ways back in the history of Israel. About 3,000 years before this, we read in Isaiah 58, "Is this the kind of fast I have chosen? Only a day for people to humble themselves? It is only for bowing one's head like a reed and for laying in sackcloth and ashes? Is that what you call a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord?" In this context, people had chosen to go without food, but they continued to act in all sorts of ways that weren't in the way of Yahweh. They were breaking the fast in a different way. And Jesus lets us know early on in this passage, don't fast like you're behind glass walls. Don't fast like you're on display. Don't fast in a way that says, everybody can see me. I'm up for observation. How should you fast? Like this. "But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen." In our context, make sure that you actually took time to get a shower and to do your hair. Go out looking like you would normally look. Don't try to look different. Don't try to get attention in that way. Dallas Willard says this, "When we have learned well to fast, we will not suffer from it. It will bring strength and joy. We will not be miserable, and so Jesus tells us not to look miserable." This, for me, was one of the hardest things to believe about fasting, and still something that I honestly wrestle with, the idea that actually fasting could become a pleasure. It could actually be something that I entered into joyfully in the way that I might enter into prayer or into giving. There are people that would say there is this way that you can fast that actually celebrates the fact that there is something happening that is worth chasing after. It's not about misery anymore. Don't fast like you're in behind glass walls. Fast like you are behind brick walls seems to be the message that Jesus gives us. Fast in a way that you imagine nobody can see you. Choose to fast secretly. I wish that I could tell you in some ways that the language Jesus uses here was the language of if. Unfortunately, the language he uses is the language of when. It doesn't say to us if you choose to fast, in the same way that he doesn't say if you pray. He doesn't say if you give. He keeps using this awkward, provocative word, when. When you fast, when you fast, when you fast. It seems like this is an essential in Jesus' mind to living in the way of Jesus. Not because it earns us something, because it unlocks something for us. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others that they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face. When? This is probably hard for us to understand in the 21st century because we've moved so far away from this culture, but I want you to catch hold of this amazing John Wesley quote. John Wesley was a serious guy in the 18th century. He began the Methodist movement and he had some intensity to him. So when you know John Wesley's going to speak, you know, man, he's going to go for the throat. He doesn't mess around. And so read this and don't feel guilty because this isn't a guilt thing. I fear, there are now thousands of Methodists, so-called, both in England and Ireland, who, following the same bad example, have entirely left off fasting, who are so far from fasting twice in the week, as all the stricter Pharisees did, that they do not fast twice in a month. Are there not some of you who do not fast one day from beginning of the year to the end? But what excuse can there be for this? John Wesley looked around his society of people that had come to follow Jesus, and he said, I can't believe it. There's hardly anyone that's fasting 2 days a week anymore. I'm shocked and appalled by this kind of behavior. They're not even fasting twice a month. I think us in our 21st century context, we look at that and we say, ouch. Like, what would he say about our society today? Because it looks very different. For at least a millennia and a half, there was a tradition that Christians fasted twice a day. They followed that Jewish practice. Twice a week, sorry. They followed that Jewish practice. They took the Tuesday and Thursday that Jewish people had fasted, and they turned it into Monday and Wednesday, or to Wednesday and to Friday. This was part of Christian culture for a millennia and a half. And now it kind of feels like it's maybe gotten lost. Seems like Jesus teaches fasting is essential. For a millennia and a half, Christians assumed that fasting was essential. And now we're landed with today wrestling with what do we do about this? Is this something that we are supposed to enter into? Now let me just say this. There may be all sorts of reasons why you might say, I actually just can't do this. And this is a grace thing, remember, not a law thing. If you are perhaps at a certain age where you need to have that regular intake of food, then this might not be for you right now. If you're going through something like a pregnancy, it might not be for you right now. If you have struggles with eating disorders, then this might not be for you right now. But for the most of us, it seems like the teaching of Jesus is this is for you to enter into somewhere. Find a way to do this in a healthy way. And so whenever Jesus gives a command, I always like to obey it, but just by nature, I always like to ask this question. I always like to ask why. Why does Jesus say this? Because when I understand the reason, I'm usually more excited about doing it. Yes, he's my savior, he's my master, I'll obey a command, but when I can catch the heartbeat for it, that usually helps me to jump in more eagerly. So why? Why, Jesus, why would you say do something like take away people's donuts? Why would you say do something like go without food for an extended period of time when it is a necessity? And unfortunately, the answer for us is not far away. In Matthew chapter 4, if you just flick back a page or two, we read this. And then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, if you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. Jesus answered, it is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Bread isn't enough to sustain you. You need something else. Now, when you read bread in Scripture, I would suggest bread sometimes just means bread. But in lots of ways, bread is a code word. It's the thing that sustains. What he's not saying is, well, you can't live on bread alone, but if you only eat steak, you'll be fine. Or you only eat donuts, you'll be fine. He's not giving you other options. He's just saying food or the thing that you've come to rely on. So bread for you may not be bread, but it's probably something. For me, it may not be bread, but there's probably something that I've come to believe sustains life, when perhaps it doesn't. My wife has become what I would consider an expert on making sourdough. She makes these regularly and often, and they are gorgeous. Just look at that after not eating a donut. Does it not feel compelling? Does it not feel like it just wants some of that. It means my definition of bread has changed. Now when I come home and say, is there any bread? I mean specifically a certain thing. I don't mean, is there like Wonder Bread tucked away in the cupboard somewhere? I mean, is the real bread? Is the fresh bread? Is the this kind of bread? My definition of bread has changed. And your definition of bread may be one thing for real bread, but there's probably something, as I say, in your life that you say, no, this is the thing that I really need, the thing that keeps me going. I would say in our lives, this is true. We define what bread is, and then we need to have it to be full. We need to have it to be full. So for you, it could be anything. For you, the thing that you need could be marriage. For you, the thing that you need could be kids. For you, the thing that you need could be an extra 10% on your income. For you, the thing that you need could be the newest car. For you, the thing that you need could be lobster for dinner. The thing that you need could be almost anything. You build, and I build, a list very quickly, and we chase after it and say, this is the thing that will make me full. This will be the thing that tells me I've had enough when I've scaled the company up to a certain level. When I've picked up the new hobby, when I've bought the new set of golf clubs, when I've made it to enough things, concerts, games that I want to make it to, when my kids are really achieving in school, when they're now like in the next gymnastics level, whatever it is, there's a thing that we often chase, and that becomes our bread. It's a thing that we need to feel that we're enough, feel that we're full. Fasting reveals that thing. Fasting, I would suggest, reveals to us the things we use to feel full in life. Sometimes it can be food, but often it can be something else too. It can be something else. Fasting reveals to us the things that we need to feel full. And to give that some sort of group terms, I love this quote from Alan Hirsch, who's a missiologist, just a guy that's planted some amazing church communities around the world. He says this: we have an obsession, primarily in the West, with safety and security, comfort and convenience. Perhaps those are the things that allow us to feel full. The more luxurious house, the more luxurious car, the bigger bank account. The things that will protect me from everything that might happen. Safety, comfort, security, convenience, being able to get whatever I want whenever I want to be able to get it. Fasting plays with those things. It starts to reveal just how important they are to us. Perhaps for a moment you might think about the way that if you're at home for the day by yourself, you go about eating. If you're someone like me, and I can confess this, and if this isn't you, this is fine. When I'm home by myself, I tend to wander around the house looking for the next thing to consume, and the next thing to consume, and the next thing to consume. The other day, I was in Costco with my family, and I bought a 54-ounce bag of mini eggs. You know, those chocolate eggs with the little shells on them. And so I would find myself at home by myself going over to this big, giant bag of mini eggs, and I'd take like a handful out, and I'd wander off, and I'd just consume them, and then something would start to stir in me that said, that wasn't enough, that wasn't the right amount, like you didn't get your hand like fully in the bag, and you didn't like grab hard enough. And so I would kind of find myself edging back over to where I was, and just wandering, looking, oh, I see more mini eggs, and I would go back to the thing time and time again. If you're like me, you might find that happens in so many different things. That the body that we began this whole thing with is weak enough that it wanders, and it wants all of the different things that it might be able to get. Fasting reveals to us those things and shows us how we rely on them. Fasting reveals to us the things we use to feel full, and then reveals to us that we are actually empty. It takes away those things and reveals the emptiness that lurks at the core of us. It reveals the way that we use those things to feel good about life, to cover up for just a moment that center that is empty. The brilliant Ronald Rollheiser, and if you were going to read one book this year, I would suggest his book, Holy Lung, is something that I've just started to tap into and just absolutely love. It's just so compelling. Said this: we stall, we distract ourselves, drug the pain, party and travel, stay busy, try this and that, cling to people and moments, junk up the surface of our lives, and find any and every excuse to avoid being alone and having to face ourselves. And on this wonderfully practical level, going without food for an extended period of time starts to bring that out of us. Now, it might be that you might say, I'd like to fast something that isn't food, because I feel like it would be more helpful. And that could be a good conversation to push into. But I would say start with food. You'll be surprised at how much just having an empty stomach starts to grab your attention. There's other things that we might fast that we can actually surprisingly go without for a longer period of time, but food does this thing where it starts to get you right in the stomach for some reason or another. It starts to get our attention quickly, and that perhaps is part of our problem. The writer Helen Keller says this: in general life, most of us are not paying attention. She's blind. And she talks about the way that she engages with the world around her. She says, I get more from touching and holding a rose than you do by looking at it. Something about our ability to get almost anything we want whenever we want it sends us into this fog that enables us to see almost nothing around us. And this is part of the problem that fasting is trying to address. We're invited to pay attention more closely to the world around us, and this physical hunger is often just enough to begin to do that. Fasting reveals to us the things that we use to feel full, and then potentially, beautifully releases us from the things we use to feel full. Suddenly the hold is broken. If you've ever done a fast like Whole30, where you've taken 30 days off sugar, you may have experienced this practically. There's this moment where after not eating sugar for 30 days, you have this moment where you say, I no longer want sugar anymore. Fasting creates this opportunity for us to be able to embrace something else. It releases us from the things that we use to feel full and allows us to be filled. It creates a spiritual hunger that God feels for us that is truly transformative. And I want you to catch hold for just a second how transformative Jesus says this in this next few verses. In Matthew 17, we read this: when they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. Lord, have mercy on my son, he said. He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him. A man comes to disciples of Jesus desperate for help, desperate for guidance, and the disciples of Jesus can do nothing. They can do nothing. And watch what happens next. You unbelieving and perverse generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? I feel like Jesus might have said this about me so many times. It's like, really? Again? Bring the boy here to me. Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of the boy, and he was healed at that moment. Then the disciples came to Jesus in private and asked, why couldn't we drive it out? The man who needed our help, the person who was desperate, though we actually wanted to help, why could we do nothing? Why could we do nothing? Why were we so powerless? He replied, because you have so little faith. Truly, I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Man, there's so much there that we don't have time to get into, because we have rocky mountains, and I don't know if anyone's moved them recently, but I have not. Nothing will be impossible for you, but this type only comes out by prayer and fasting. Jesus reflects with his disciples on their inability to act with power in a specific situation and says the reason you were unable to do this was a lack of two things: prayer and fasting. We often find ourselves pushing into prayer, but fasting remains undone. Interestingly, Jesus seems to hold to this idea. Fasting affects change in the world. Why? Why does it change the world? Because it affects change in you. And it affects change in me. It is this one thing that Jesus describes in this passage as being truly transformative. And we as followers of Jesus in the 21st century would probably hold up our hands and say, I leave it undone. I leave it undone. None of this is supposed to make you feel guilty. This is an invitation. As Jesus says, an invitation to a different level of maturity. But it seems that Jesus offers us here something that he says is truly compelling, truly transformative. And we leave it undone. We leave it undone. So a question for us, another one. When Jesus says something, I like to ask why. When I understand it, I like to ask how. How do we enter into the way of Jesus with this? And so some encouragement for you, I hope. Recognize that what Jesus invites us to is not just trying really hard. I've tried that, it doesn't work. Trying does not work. But he does invite us, in the language of John Ortberg, into something else. He invites us into training. He invites us into first steps. Are there any runners in the building? Who loves to run? How many marathon runners in the building? How many of you have done the dreaded 26.2? Raise a clear hand, I want to count. Some of you, wow, look at you guys go. Peter at the back is like, yes, I feel like you've done more than one if you're going to hold your hand that high. There's got to be several under your belt. Look at you. Three? Wow. There we go. Yeah, crazy. Who does that kind of thing? Most of the rest of us, if we try to run a marathon tomorrow, it doesn't matter how hard we try. You can't do it. You'll collapse and die on the journey. You just can't get through it. It's not about trying to do it. It's about training to do it. Because in actual fact, while maybe 4% of the room put their hand up and say they've done it, perhaps 80% of the room could do it. You just have to decide you really want to do it. You train and you train and you train and you run 10 miles and then, well, maybe you don't start with 10 miles, you run 1 mile and then you maybe do 10 miles and then maybe you get to that point where you get to 26.2 and then you decide that wasn't enough and you start doing ultra marathons and all of these other types of things. But training is essential. So don't just try really hard. Begin a practice that says, I'm going to learn to do this. Don't go and do Jesus 40-day fast off the bat. You'll die. Seriously, you will actually die. Train. Start to do some elements that might help you to step into it. Set a time. Traditionally, there's a couple of fast days in the year for Christians. One is coming up just around the corner. Good Friday has traditionally been a fast day. Maybe try going without one meal and using that time to pray, to engage in conversation with the God of the universe. I fast on Tuesdays. It's the day that our elders meet. It's the day that our lead team for staff meet and our staff team as a whole meet. Perhaps that's something you'd like to step into. Remember, this is an invitation. I'm not telling you to do it. It's description, not prescription. That might be a day that we pick as a church and say, we're going to all enter it on that day because we believe something's happening that we want to see grow and move forward. Set a time. Just give it a try. Try one meal. Try fasting breakfast and lunch and then gathering with your family to eat in the evening. Then maybe try 24 hours. Maybe try a couple of days. Try using that time to say, God, how might you be revealing things to me that I've kind of relied on? And how would you transform my life and my world because of this practice? Set a time. Find a rhythm. Start to feel how it works, how you maybe even, in this weird way, start to look forward to the day that you fast. And then do this, and this is the key element, because this is what we're trying to get to. Ask God for spiritual hunger. And perhaps you might say, I don't remember the last time I felt that, or I'm not sure I've ever felt that. And that's okay, we're learning to ride bikes here. It's fine. Step into that. Ask God for that spiritual hunger. And here's the wonderful thing. That is a prayer he sometimes and terrifyingly sometimes he answers. He answers. He builds that in you. It may cost you something, but it may also be worth it. Team are going to lead us in a song about hunger. I'm going to invite you to stand with me. And this may be something that you would love someone to pray with you over. We have a great prayer team that love to walk this journey with people. They're over at the back, they're sometimes at the sides. They have little things on that say, I can pray for you. Maybe you're saying, I've never had a spiritual hunger ever in my life. Perhaps you'd like to have someone pray for you. Perhaps you're saying, I just don't feel it now. I feel so dry and tired of this. Perhaps you'd like someone to pray for you. But wherever you are, my invitation is to you is to pray with me now. So just for a moment, reflect on some of the things that there might be things we've come to rely on. There may be things that are getting in the way. There may be good things. There's nothing wrong on the surface with safety and security, comfort and convenience. But if you let them get in the way of a life pursuing Jesus, something is missing. So for a second, would you hold out your hands with me? And if you feel brave enough, say this in your own words. God, I am holding a lot of things in my hand. I open them up to you. I ask you to take what I've come to rely on and replace it with spiritual hunger. Would you affect change in me? And through that, affect change in the world. Amen.
If you've been touched by this ministry and you want that to spread to others, you might consider partnering with us financially. You can give online at southfellowship.org/give. Thanks for listening and have a great rest of your day.